Yes, Ginger Millerman and the Fountain of Life, 11 minutes after the hour on a Wednesday, and we're joined by Doug Greenwald, the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times out there in Columbia, Maryland. Doug, good morning. Happy and winsome Wednesday to you.
Good morning, guys. We're going to be in the 80s all week here in Maryland, and that's just delightful for us.
How's the humidity?
All right.
How's the humidity?
Actually, the humidity has been down, so we have not had a lot of 90s and high humidity days this summer, which is great. Yeah.
I was watching a ball game in Cincinnati on TV yesterday, and they were commenting about how cool the weather and how humidity's been entirely missing. I mean, it's gorgeous. It's like mid-70s and sunshine and very, very pleasant. I'm wondering what's going on here. Should we be worried?
I don't know. Are you covering the tomato plants with bushel baskets there in East Dakota
actually,
these evenings?
We don't have to. It is so nice here, too. We're looking at 80 degrees and sunshine and just, you know, that soft, sweet-smelling summer air. Just gorgeous up here. So we're glad to be alive this summer. We really are. And we're looking forward to talking today because, you know, sometimes, I hate to tell you this, Doug, but sometimes it takes you forever to get us to where we're going. We've been promoting the woman at the well conversation, and we finally got into a little bit last week. But you keep discovering so much to teach us that we kind of get overeager, I think. Maybe that's just our Greek Western trained mindset, huh?
Why are you in such a hurry?
Well, I don't know.
Or is it David who's in a hurry?
Well, no, it's not me.
Getting
it's
there Jim. Is half the fun. Maybe it's three-quarters of the fun is what
it's, it's all Jim. It's not me. Yeah. I didn't do it. Yep. No. You're not going to pin this one on me.
Yeah. Oh, Doug, you must prepare for these in lots of ways that we can't even imagine. I know you have your favorite authors and your favorite books. I mean, you can open the book of John and just read that, but you know, where do you get all those contextual things? What have you been reading these days? What do you choose to read?
Well, you know, in the last several days, I started reading a new book. I had some friends come by the house last week from Michigan and Colorado, and one of them was carrying a book called The Great Evangelical Recession. Six Factors That Will Crash the American Church. And I thought, You know, a year or two ago, I wrote a book on basically Western discipleship, sort of developing the thesis that we need to declare that puppy dead and bury it. Mm-hmm. Hence, it was called the Drip Series, Discipleship, Rest in Peace. So, I've not been the biggest fan of what's been going on, or I should probably say the biggest observer of what's not going on. So anyway, I picked up this book and thought, well, is this going to be just another scare book, or what is it? It's written by a man named John Dickerson. And I went through his diagnosis, and I said, spot on. Mm-hmm. He makes 6 points. And all of this is background to why evangelism and discipleship are so crucial and why we're losing the battle in evangelism and discipleship these days in Western evangelicalism. He starts out with a whole bunch of surveys that point out that the Western evangelicalism, the American Evangelical Church, is a lot smaller than people have thought. Maybe 7% of the population, maybe 22 million people max. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, it's steadily shrinking. So this notion that evangelicalism is still a big force in America, culturally speaking, for many evangelicals who live in their own cocoon, this data just sort of explodes that myth. Evangelicalism is a lot smaller than we thought it was, and that may explain why we're having so little impact. The second observation he makes is that over the last 30 years or so, the culture and secularism is on a fast rise as evangelicalism is dropping. Secularism is shifting from tolerating Christianity to starting to persecute Christianity. And you can pull up all sorts of news reports around the country of, you know, a counselor in a clinic who's a Christian, and a person comes in with homosexual leaning issues, and that counselor says, you know, I really think for conflict of interest reasons, I'd like to shift this patient over to another counselor, and they fire her on the spot. Mm. a pastor who reads the Bible outside of a school gets arrested. I mean, it goes on and on and on and on. And I think most of us are not thinking about the fact that the hatred towards Western evangelicalism is more significant than we realize. The third phenomenon, he said, that is shrinking the Western evangelical church is all of its internal divisions, particularly those who have tried to politicize Christianity. Mm-hmm. And the whole younger generation is just turned off when the thought or that the evangelical right and Christianity need to be viewed as one and the same. And so while it's the older people who are the, you know, focus on the family followers and the Jerry Falwell followers, the younger generation is just tuning that notion out. They still see themselves as Christians, but more and more they're labeling themselves as independents. And then when you factor in, you know, all of the theological issues that have always been going on between Calvinism and Arminianism and covenantal theology versus dispensationalism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you have a sort of a divided house that is smaller than we think and is steadily shrinking. Then the fourth observation he makes is this, that the American church is headed towards bankruptcy. Giving in the aggregate for American churches continues to decline every year. Some churches are experiencing double-digit declines on contributions, offerings, year after year after year. He said the trend is inevitable. The giving generation, which is mostly guys like me and you and other people and women of our age, are dying. And we were the steady tithers. We were the more regular givers. And that thought, that practice, that view has not been passed on to the younger generation. They're far stingier in terms of their giving to the church. And then you get to the fifth reason, and this is why I decided to even bring this subject up. This chapter is called The Evangelical Church in America is Bleeding, and by that he means we're losing our young. The American church would grow at the rate of the population growth if simply our kids joined the church and became followers of Jesus Christ. Or forget about joining a church, just became followers of Jesus Christ. Data is coming out, which is will sort of take your breath away. But when you average all the data, 2 out of 3 evangelical kids raised in an evangelical church, 2 out of 3 will walk away from the faith by the time they're 29 years old. Can you imagine that? We're losing 2 out of 3 of our kids in the American Evangelical
but
Church.
Hasn't that been a pattern for a long, long time, though? I'm thinking of the old stories of pastors' kids that are raised in the church, and they get to be teenagers, and they start to rebel, and they leave, but ultimately come back. I mean, is there that hope?
Well, he spends several pages on the theory that they'll come back, and that the evidence seems to be absolutely not. They don't. And so you got 2 phenomena going on here. We're losing 2 out of 3 of our own kids to the faith, away from the faith. And the 1/3 that remains has a very muddled theology. They sort of have a deistic view of God that his job is to make them happy. Okay? And they're not particularly faith-sharing at all. And so their worldview is not the same worldview that most of us have traditionally grown up with. And so all of this is combining together, and he says the great evangelical American church is heading for a crash, mm-hmm. and it may be less than 10 years away, which is fascinating. I mean, just take the money thing. We have developed a ministry model that says professionals do the ministry, and those of us in the pew write out the checks to allow them to do that. Well, that model is probably not going to survive. More and more pastors are going to have to find tent-making jobs. Mm-hmm. More and more of the pew is going to have to realize they're going to have to pick up part of the ministry. You just can't pay professionals to do it anymore. And that American evangelicalism has been on a dollar binge, you know, over the last 30 or 40 years. And that source of that funding is drying up far more rapidly than most people even realize. Anyway, all of that is prologue to why I think John 4 and the study of the master evangelist at work is so important, because the American Evangelical Church is losing its own, is not really bringing converts in to replace them at any significant rate. And if something doesn't change, we may be looking at a rare and extinct species.
Well, I think, and I don't want to distract you from John 4, because I'm not quite sure when you're going to jump into that, but you've opened up a whole arena for discussion here, and I would suggest that the evangelical church has been in need of massive repairs for a couple of decades here, at least. And there is some good news out there, too, and we don't need to get into a discussion of it now unless you choose, but there is a book out there called Slow Church, which posits an answer for this very dilemma you're talking about. And it's called Slow Church. It's by two pastors, Christopher Smith, who's a pastor in Indiana, and John Pattison, pastor out in Oregon. And they've gotten together, collaborated on this book, and basically they're saying smaller and slower, back to the basics, back to more like the first church was. And they talk about the economy of God, and the ecology of God that is reconciling all things, not just humankind, but all things in his creation back to him, that we're in the process of doing that. And we have to think on a whole different scale in many different ways. And in a way, this kind of is an offshoot of the slow food movement, which has similar philosophical roots, that as we get back to growing our own food, not going the corporate route, we share it, we do it in community, we enjoy the benefits of it together. And this expands the same kind of thinking to the whole church. I think you'll find it, it's not a big book. It's a paperback. You can get an ebook version of it. But it's so deep, you gotta kind of wade through it. It's not hard to read, but you want to sit there and absorb every word. I recommend it to you. I think you'll feel better about where the church just might be headed. If their way of thinking actually catches on, I think we're going to be in good shape. It'll take, it's slow church. It might take a generation or two, though, to get to that point.
Back to your book, Doug. Does he talk about any root causes for some of these symptoms?
Well, I'm going to put it in some pretty crass marketing language, at least in terms of why the kids are falling away from the faith or just walking away from the faith. They're not buying the product we're selling. And it isn't necessarily our words, it's the way we live our lives. And I think they would argue they don't see any difference between the way many Christians live their lives and the way many secular families live it in the culture. The divorce rates are the same, all that sort of stuff. And maybe they don't sense it's genuine, maybe they don't sense it's real. I mean, I don't know. I'm only halfway through the book. I have to go through six solutions to the diagnosis that this book just generated. But Jim, to connect the dots there, I think these two boats are harmonic, because this book says the American Evangelical Church as we know it is dying. Mm-hmm. And what you're talking about is what's left. And in the greater sweep of church history, oftentimes the only thing that's left is a remnant. And it is amazing what God has done through church history through the remnant. Think of Zinzendorf and those revivals. So the slow church, even though I haven't read it and don't know what its thesis particularly is, may well be the end of the road for what I'm reading right now. But it does seem that the American Evangelical Church is in some form of death throes, and what emerges from it is yet to be seen. I hope the slow church is one of those outcomes.
Well, I think if you get a hold of the book, you'll find it interesting and very encouraging. But you're right in the sense of a remnant. It's kind of like what we'll distill out of the current evangelical church, but it will be genuine and effective, and rooted in your locale, your neighborhood, and part of the fabric of everyday life. So anyway,
and again, to connect some more dots, the churches that are showing this impact the fastest, or the most dramatic, are the big box churches.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, I was talking with my wife about that, and she said, It's hard to feel loyal to a big box church. But you can feel loyal to a local community church where you know the people well. And so that may be part of the dynamic is we have to get back to community-based church where we truly have relationships and know the people within them and experience the priesthood of all believers together in a very vital body life, which is awfully hard to do, it seems, in the bigger box churches.
Mm-hmm. And you've just summarized slow church in a very very articulate way.
I don't know if this is of assistance or if it just muddies the water more, but there we went to church twice in Malawi during the trip, and the first one we went to church in a very traditional, it was an evangelical church at ELCM on the sign out front. And the minister happened to be an area bishop who also taught at one of the local seminaries. And, you know, church was open windows. There was no glass in the windows. The doors were fairly open. The floors were patched concrete. And it was kind of looked like it was put together by the people in the area. And the pews were filled. Very traditional, very straight down the middle, all the women on one side, all the men on the other side. Women took communion second after the men took communion. Well, it might have been first, but we were invited to take place in communion, and the place was filled. The music was very, very nice and very pleasant, and all vocal, all a cappella. The second church we went to was kind of a New Age kind of version of Lutheran. And the minister was stood up front with his Bible and kind of railed back and forth and had a very good sermon. They had a full band, one of the best rhythm guitarists I have ever heard anywhere. He was doing some heavy duty licks and a drum section and two or three voices, and we had rocking and rolling and lots of activities. And I think there was 12 people in the aisles. It might have been, well, I guess it was 14 because there was 7 in our group and there was at least another 7 people. But it seemed that, you know, the first church was back to the basics, neighborhood outreach. Everybody knew each other. Everybody, they talked about during the sermon and during the presentation, talked about brother this and sister that. And the second one was held in a kind of a business space downtown and didn't have its own parking lot. You had to get through. And it was a rented space. Maybe just from the people that were there or the number of people that were in the pews suggests maybe that the old ways are, at least in Malawi, have a pretty good hold.
Well, you know, you mentioned the word community a couple times, and I think that's absolutely key. Africa is a communal culture in many ways, and so that would transfer over. And when I look back after being in Protestant churches for 40-some years, the most vital church experiences that Nancy and I have had have been in community churches, where we just about knew everybody in the church, and the church was no bigger than 350 people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
You can identify with it. You take personal ownership of it. And there's just a lot of dynamics there. It's the priesthood of all believers in community. But, you know, that reminds me of another thing. I mean, we had the Reformation, and we have the 5 solas. But I think the 6th sola never got touched, and that is we need to redeem and recover and restore the priesthood of all believers. As soon as we developed clericalism and we had them in the pulpits and the rest of us in the pew, something profoundly changed. And that still lingers with us today. And I think the last aspect of the Reformation, if you will, that has yet to be discovered is the rediscovery, or for some, the discovery for the very first time of what really is meant by the priesthood of all believers living in community together.
Well, I think what I'm hearing in the background of those thoughts is the word Sabbath. And that's the third leg in slow church. And it's their position that there were not 6 days of creation, there were 7. And that God's real gift to man was on the seventh day, was the Sabbath itself. That's time to commune with God directly. And the way they put it is, I won't spoil it for anybody, but wonderfully articulate and convincing language they use to tell you that the Sabbath is really critical to the existence and the good health of the church. And we've, by and large, bypassed it here. There is no real Sabbath. Sunday is just another day. And we may spend it in a different place for an hour, but then it's back to business as usual. And the whole notion of a Sabbath rest is a key part of what the church needs to become to survive. It's too big a thing just to gloss over and forget.
Well, if you're a large church or if you're a slow church, Jesus's great assumption, of course you will be making disciples at the end of Matthew, still needs to be lived out. And so both those churches have to be able to bring new believers into their fellowship to have organic growth. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think John 4 is so important to us. Here is Jesus giving us a great example of how to do, and I don't like to use this word, but I'm going to suspend my boycott of the word evangelism for this little mini-series here. We're watching the great evangelist do evangelism. And as we see, as he gets to about the seventh verse in John 4, Jesus goes to a well in Samaria. And, you know, before we blow past that verse, It may be helpful just to observe here, if you want to bring sinners into the family of God, you have to go where sinners go.
Hmm.
If you expect that the sinners, I'm going to put that word in quotes, if you stand in the narthex of our churches and wait for sinners to come up the front steps because they want to hear our organ, it'll never happen. If you expect the sinners to walk up our front steps because they want to hear our praise band, good luck. You have to go where sinners go. And so if you're going to bring college students into the family of God, you got to go where college students go when college students go there. If you want to bring international students into the family of God, you have to go where international students go when international students go there. If you want to bring young professionals into the family of God, you have to go where young professionals go when young professionals go there. I mean, it's almost so obvious that we miss it here, is evangelism generally does not take place within a church. It takes place where sinners are. And if I look at my own practices and I look at the practices of my friends, we're having a pretty nice time together. But boy, we don't deliberately and intentionally go out to where sinners are all that much with the idea of establishing relationships, which can ultimately be redemptive. So one of the first things that hit me over the head here as I started to walk through John 4 was Jesus goes where sinners go.
Hmm.
Any thoughts?
Well, my first thought was I'm thinking of a song by Buddy Green called Jesus Has Left the Building. And in the song, he describes that, you know, Jesus, all these folks waiting behind the doors at First Church aren't going to find him there. He's out on the street doing what he came to do. And I think what you brought up is important. And again, I'm sitting here advocating slow church, but that's exactly what they talk about. Is a church cementing itself, weaving itself into the fabric of its neighborhood, and not worrying about church planning, leapfrogging around, trying to build numbers, but to totally involve themselves with the people in their community and be the hands and feet, and not within their church doors, but being out where the people are. And I love the thought, and I think your analysis is correct, that that's one of the fatal blows. Or the fatal diseases, I should say, in modern Western evangelicalism. We build ivory towers. We insulate ourselves from the world. We don't want to get contaminated. We won't touch them. We won't talk to them. We'll turn our backs on them and talk to each other because that's cleaner.
Yeah, and as I thought about Jesus sitting at this well and approaching this well, waiting for this woman to appear, I started to try to think creatively about what Jesus did not do. We're about to see what he does do. But first and foremost, he doesn't arrive that well with a Deuteronomy scroll in his hand so we can hit this woman over the head when she shows up with God's word. He doesn't have tracts in his palm or in his tunic that he can quickly press it into her palm and tell her that she's a sinner going to hell and then retreat with a self-satisfied sense of smugness that there, I've confronted her with the truth. I've done my job. Well done, thou good and faithful servant. He doesn't lay out in detail everything he knows about her life, a lot of which is not very pretty. He keeps it to himself. He doesn't open up with a canned witness statement that he's memorized. And he doesn't take an elitist approach by saying how fortunate you are that I've even condescended to talk to you about God. As a matter of fact, what we'll see is he humbles himself to lift her up. And so I was struck by so many of the stereotypes that I've observed. Each one of those things at some point in my past here doesn't happen. And that's because Jesus, I'm going to use some other language here, but sizes up his audience. He knows who this woman is. He knows all the rejection, all the sense of humiliation she's received because of this five husband thing and now living with a man who is not your husband. And he's not going to confront her with that as his opening statement, as his first phase. He realizes that nothing's going to happen unless you establish a relationship. And so he carefully thinks through, who is this person I'm interacting with? You know, and again, if you'll permit me to use some crass language here, from a marketing perspective, he tries to understand his customer. I'm amazed at how many people want to do evangelism but don't want to take the time to identify with, let alone get to know, the person is that they want to interact with about the saving, redemptive power of Jesus Christ. It's almost like it's easier to witness to strangers than it is to people we know.
And I've got just a quick story here, because what you've just described is a human foible, I think, and not just within the church. But I've quite a background in sales, outside sales, manufacturing. A manufacturer's rep is what I did for years. My dad was in the business, and we saw in the 80s a change in the way customers were dealt with. There was a time when salesmen would travel their territories and build honest relationships with their customers. They would do exactly what you described, get to know them first, understand the needs, the priorities, the characteristics, and they would then provide a product that they knew them to need. And that was part of the presentation, and it took time. You might have to call on somebody. It's hardly ever the first call, you get a sale, second, it might be 5, 6, 7 calls until you have the rapport established to where they trust you and can accept your information. But in the 80s, the companies, rather than hiring salesmen who built relationships, started hiring hourly employees who would go into, in this case, they were retail stores, they were gift and card shops and the like, take an inventory on a handheld computer and fax in an order and leave. Almost no contact with the store owner. So it was a whole sea change in the way customers were perceived and dealt with. Technology enabled that, even encouraged it, and made it cheaper than building solid relationships. And my observations in that industry over the 20 years after that, where I was a part of it, was it's going downhill fast because relationships have taken a back seat.
Let me add to that. Yeah. What you've just described is telemarketing evangelism.
Exactly.
You know, let's try to get this done in a 2-minute phone call. Maybe I can get your order. Yeah, a lot of similarities there. And, you know, Jesus deals with the obvious information. The woman is coming at noon. Now, nobody comes at noon. It gets hot in the Middle East. You either are going to get your water at the beginning of the day or at the end of the day, but not at midday. Secondly, she comes alone. This is a communal world. So you have to conclude intentionally, she wants to be alone. I mean, this even you and I could conclude this sitting at the well, all right? So I'm not talking about things that Jesus observes that we're incapable of observing. Thirdly, she's not only coming alone, but there's no man with her to protect her. I mean, this is not necessarily safe environments here in the first century. So there must be a man in her life, if there is a man, who doesn't even think she's worth protecting. Secondly, or thirdly, or fourthly, wherever we are in this skein of events here, she's coming alone, and that means there are no kids coming with her. And that suggests the whole issue of barrenness. And if that's true, then we know if the Samaritan culture operates at all in similar manner and fashions to the observant Jewish culture of the first century. We know from Elizabeth in John 1 that to be barren is to be shamed, is to be scorned, is to be derided, because that's an obvious example situation that we know God doesn't like you. So Jesus and you and I culturally could have said it that well and come to those same four conclusions as he did. Now, he also knows she's had five husbands. We wouldn't have known that, but we could have deduced from the other four pieces of data that this is a woman who has been shamed, who wants to be alone intentionally, and probably who's forced to be alone because no one wants to be with her, and no one even cares on the male side of life to even want to protect her. So you can learn an awful lot about a person by just observation, and it's amazing the clues that we get in John's fourth chapter here to start to give us, as obviously as well as Jesus, insight into the kind of person that we're dealing with here, because that has to shape our opening strategy and tactics about how we can most successfully engage her into a conversation that will lead to dialogue.
You know, you've said time and again that everything Jesus did was intentional. And in a way, that's the opposite of superficial. We have encounters day to day with people, and it's, hi, how are you? How have you been? How's, what do you think of the weather? And good luck, take care of yourself, and we're gone. Missing a chance maybe to relate on important things. There's so many casual acquaintances in life these days. We're so busy and we're moving fast. In this case, Jesus was very intentional and was anything but superficial.
Absolutely true. And added to the dynamic that you just discussed is the fact that we don't disclose what's going on. How you doing? Fine. Yeah, fine. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, fine, sure. Fine. And yet we may be hemorrhaging on the inside. Mm-hmm. And so not only do we have short conversations, probably because we have short conversations, nothing meaningful ever gets transacted. But I see we're running out of time here. And so let's just pause this with all this sizing up that Jesus has just done, with his understanding of who it is he's going to have an interaction with. He now devises his consummate strategy of how to engage her in a way that will have the highest probability of allowing dialogue to unfold, and he does it in just four little simple words: give me a drink. And next week, why don't we open up the five or six things that Jesus accomplishes with those four words?
Well, we will greatly look forward to that. Doug Greenwald, again, the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times, a ministry based just outside of Washington, D.C., Columbia, Maryland. They've got a wonderful website, preservingbibletimes.org, which you can link to from our website, if you're so inclined, at Broken Road Radio. BrokenRoadRadio.com. Perhaps you're listening there this morning. A click will get you there, and you'll see a lot of beautiful photographs. You'll discover resources that you may not have known existed for teaching context, the historic and now not just the Hebrew context, but the context of Rome as well. Doug leads tours to both Israel now and to Italy kind of following in the footsteps of Paul and learning what he dealt with, what he confronted, his challenges, and it opens up whole new layers of understanding. So preservingbibletimes.org, it's a recommended stop as you surf the net. And Doug, thank you so much. We'll check in with you again next Wednesday. You going to be available?
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, okay.
Well, yeah, thanks, Doug.
We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Shalom, shalom.
Shalom.